episode 5.
Good to go.
Welcome to the Unforgiving 60 with your hosts, Ben Pronk and Tim Curtis.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to episode 5 of the Unforgiving 60. I'm joined, as always, by my faithful co-host, Tim.
And I'm joined by my co-host, Ben.
No, you're doing the joining.
Am I the joiner or the joinee?
You're the joinee. Regardless, we're coming off the back of a fantastic episode. Last episode, episode 4, if you haven't already listened, go and check it out. It was a wonderful discussion with a guy called Tim Robertson, who we've labelled chronic overachiever. Really interesting talk about his journey through such incredible career milestones as being an F-18 fighter pilot in the Australian Air Force, through to command in action with the Special Air Service Regiment in Australia, the Special Boat Service over in the UK, and then a pretty interesting career post-military.
Very non-linear.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. What were your takeaways? What did you walk away from that episode?
You know, I've known Robbo for a long time. Probably not many knowledge bombs from him. No. Two things. The first one is don't underestimate the value of hard work.
They completely miss the late nights, the hard times, the crying in toilet cubicles during fighter course.
And Malcolm Gladwell talks about this in The Principle of 10,000 Hours and whether that's the magic number or not, Ben. I think hard work, full stop. And in that same bucket, take a chance. If Robbo did one thing, he took some serious chances and he left a lot behind him in taking those chances, or he risked a lot. And the next link thing to that same theory is that there's no such thing as busy. I mean, he talked about training for selection, flying, you know, training for selection at 4 a.m.
Yep.
And then flying his fighter pilot missions to go to bed to get back up at 4 a.m. And the second one that I really liked was that he talked about successful leadership can be successful if you show empathy.
Mm.
And as a fighter pilot who came into the Special Air Service Regiment knowing not much, he was highly reliant upon the advice of his team.
Yeah.
And in showing that empathy, he grew into being a strong leader.
And
it's that principle.
Yeah, staggeringly humble as well. Staggering, because fighter pilots and humility are not things you hear sort of next to each other.
Well, probably SAS guys and humility as well, perhaps.
Yeah, well, too often than not. Look, the thing that really struck me was, and has actually stuck with me, is Robbo's discussion of defining your success. So really working out what success and I guess by extension what happiness means to you, and it's not always what we see in the movies and what we read in the books. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be a correlation with money or status or what's on your business card. It is about what is meaningful to you. And he had that wonderful little vignette of walking down the pier to his seaplane, the business he was running in Tasmania, with a coffee in his hand. No doubt a skinny soy decaf latte or whatever fighter pilot
with a lemon twist.
With a lemon twist. But just saying, you know, he was able to be in the moment and recognise that this is fantastic.
So I remember walking along Tassie seafront with a cappuccino, looking at my seaplane, just in happiness.
And I think those little vignettes, I mean, that's essentially all our life is. It's a collection of these vignettes. Mm. The old John Lennon quote that life is what happens while you're busy making other plans. I mean, it is super important to understand what success and happiness means to you and then recognise it when it's happening. You know, enjoy it, not be constantly thinking about that next deadline or the next paycheck.
What price happiness? Question mark.
Mm.
Okay, on with the show.
Cool.
Ben, now in the SAS, we worked typically a long way from our bosses. Any support and certainly consulting with our bosses over a radio or satellite communication often wasn't very practical or realistic. So we had initiative ingrained in us. I think that was one of the foundations of SAS training, was use your initiative.
I certainly remember when you were my boss trying to work as far away from you as possible. So that was possibly part of that.
that initiative was reinforced through a couple of very, very simple principles that we think is highly transferable into the corporate environment. And the initiative went from the top all the way to the lowest level, and particularly relevant inside that small group operating environment, four to six guys. We're going to talk about mission command in this particular podcast, and the importance of intent, and perhaps the importance of intent above anything else. Ooh. So what is it?
Aufsragtaktik is the answer in one word. So mission command is, it's a military leadership concept, if you like, and it can trace its roots back to the early 19th century. We spoke in a previous episode about the Prussians. I'm a big fan of dead Prussians. I think you're forced to be as a military officer. You learn a lot about Clausewitz and von Moltke and these sort of guys. But early 19th century, the Prussians were it as far as a fighting force goes. Best trained, best drilled, best disciplined, best equipped, and had a corresponding period of dominance until they were destroyed in detail by Napoleon at a twin battles of Jena and Auerstedt. And this came as a massive shock. They, I think, in many ways had tricked themselves into thinking that they were the bee's knees when it came to a military fighting force. But the reason why we speak so much about the Prussians is that they were self-aware, and they had this ability to reflect on failure and to try and draw the lessons from it. And they looked at this baffling defeat, how they, as the premier military organisation in the world at the time, could have been defeated by what they contemptuously referred to as an adhocracy. So Napoleon's army were not well disciplined, they were not well drilled in the same way that they had been. But they realised that what Napoleon was employing was what we'd now call mission command, what they sort of labelled Aufsragtaktik, which is a concept that is based on an idea of a centralised intent, very clearly defined central intent, but a very decentralised form of execution. And this kind of concept has been largely unchanged and is still in use in militaries throughout the world, and I think is a really good way of approaching a lot of contemporary business problems as well.
So decentralized execution sounds terrifying to many. What's the control measure?
Well, this is the genius of this. And in many poorly executed versions of mission command, you see leaders using it as a bit of a fire and forget. So I've given my intent. Now people go and execute. I'll be out the back having a cup of coffee. It's obviously not like that. I reckon there's three key principles behind successful implementation of mission command. And we'll probably unpack them as we go. The first one is that commander's intent, so a really clear understanding of what we need to do. The second one is, I guess, a manifestation of that intent in a well-constructed mission statement. Mm-hmm. So we, within the militaries around the world, use the kind of who, what, when, where, and why. But the big important components of that are the task and purpose. The what and the why. So not only telling you what you need to do, but telling you why you need to do it, how it links into the overall organisational mission.
Yeah, press pause there, because I mean businesses now have mission statements, mission, vision, values, and they populate themselves in different ways. The military's mission statement is different. So if we break it down, there are two parts, is that right?
Yeah, fundamentally. We're talking a task and a purpose.
And so could you give me an example of a military mission?
Sure. So if we look at that who, what, when, where, or why, 3 platoon, who, is to seize the hill at grid 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, what, when, by 1800 hours, where, we've got obviously the hill, and then why, in order to provide fire support for the company attack. So you can break that down. The key bits are the what, the task, seize the hill, and the purpose. Why are we doing that? To provide fire support for the company attack. Now, the genius in this, and we'll talk about how we use this in the planning sense and the importance of briefbacks and the common mental model, but the genius in this is that if officer commanding 3 platoon, as she's charging her band of fearless soldiers up the hill, realises that there's a better way of providing fire support for the company attack, or that the situation is not as they first perceived and that we need to make modifications, then she understands what the overall intent is. We still need to provide fire support for the company attack. And so she's able to modify her plan in the face of an unexpected event, or seize a fleeting opportunity, if there's a better position, as I said before, to provide that fire support, then she doesn't necessarily need to clear that hill. She can still achieve the overall intent by actually not even doing the task that she was assigned.
Mm. And in the SAS, we tended to focus people on the why. So everything that is written after in order to.
Mm. Mm.
And I interrupted you. So commander's intent and mission statements, breaking down a task and purpose, so everything after in order to. And the third part?
Would be back briefs. So I use that as a catch-all for this development of a common mental model. So I mentioned before, this isn't a fire and forget exercise. The commander needs to provide his or her intent. He or she then needs to provide a bunch of parameters. So these may be things like timeframes, resources, limitations in a military sense. There's all things like sort of laws of armed conflict and rules of engagements that provide constraints or limitations on how we achieve the mission. But then we let the subordinate commander come up with the how. How are they going to seize that hill in order to provide fire support? So they will then go through their planning process. But it needs to be an iterative process. There needs to be this engagement. We spoke in a previous episode about management by walking around. The engagement can be formal back briefs where we get up on our hind legs and present our concept for the commander to approve. Or it can be as simple as wandering around and saying, what do you think about this? How are you going with the plan? You got any dramas with the plan?
Mm.
And the beauty of doing that in an informal sense is that you often get much more candid feedback. The beauty of doing it in person, face-to-face, is that you can then read all those nonverbal communication signs. You can see the body language, the micro-expressions, that little sort of twitch in the eye that indicates, I'm not really sure why we're doing this, or I've got some reservations about this. And then if you're an empathetic leader, as we all aspire to be, you want to be able to unpack those and really try and dig into to the concerns, because ultimately that's making your plan better. So this idea of back briefing is that two-way process where we're making sure that our subordinate leaders understand what we're doing it and why we're doing it, and we're improving our plan by getting the benefit of their experience.
Now, we're going to talk about the relevance in contemporary business, but before we do that, can we talk a little bit about small group planning in the SAS? So the fundamental force element, reasonably small number of guys and girls.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the one thing you want to see when you present your plan is belief.
100%.
So how does that occur? How do you get belief?
I reckon the idea of ownership is a really important part. And again, we spoke in a previous episode about humility as a leader, not feeling you need to have all the answers, and also sharing power. So being able to delegate, not in the sense that you used to do, like getting people to do your work, but actually...
Well, good leaders do less.
Yeah, you do, and you're a testimony to that.
I was taught by a very, very good squadron commander when I was a troop commander, and I won't mention his name, but he certainly knows who he is. The principle of doing less was applied very strongly. In the busiest times, he could be found reading a newspaper.
Good inspirational leadership. I was talking more in the sense of actually sharing the power. So delegating real authority, giving decision-making authority down to lower levels, and actually allowing them the ability to provide input, genuine input into the plan. And again, we've spoken about this idea of driving fear from the room, having that environment where people can contribute without fear of retribution or being judged.
All right, two-part question. Why is it important, and how is it relevant to contemporary business?
I think it's super important because we live, work, breathe, exist in this complex environment, in this environment where we can't predict how any of our actions, any of our plans are going to play out with any form of certainty. And we've seen this in all sorts of contexts. You and I were listening to a great podcast with Richard Thaler this morning, and this whole idea of behavioural economics is speaking to this to some extent. There are no rational markets where people, we do funky irrational things because we've got all of these different agendas, all of these different goals we're working towards. So if we're working and living in this environment, then there's no way we as a leader can be this all-knowing oracle. We can't predict how things are going to pan out. And so we want to be able to empower our subordinates to make make decisions to seize fleeting opportunities in the heat of the moment. And this is increasingly relevant in the contemporary age because things are happening so much quicker. The decision cycle is turning around a lot faster, and we're seeing things like, you know, media stories and social media themes and viral messaging coming out so much quicker that our sort of flash to bang decision time frame is a lot shorter in a lot of contexts. So we need the people at the coalface to be empowered to make those decisions, but to understand what the intent is, to make those decisions in accordance with the commander's intent.
Mm. And so part answer, I guess, on the how is it relevant, but top tips for a business that wanted to restructure its vision, mission, values, how would it practically do that? As you walk into the company and you see it up on the signboard, it's the beacon by which the company's guided.
Yep.
How do I change it to make it more relevant? And then how do I execute?
So that is easier said than done. So I'm not pretending this is a silver bullet. The very first thing I would do is do that sanity check and have a real no kidding look as to whether your espoused vision / mission actually cascades down throughout the organisation. We talk about this idea of a golden thread of logic and having these nested missions where the task of the superior commander becomes the purpose of the subordinate commander. So there is this nice thread of logic between what everyone in the mission is doing, in the organization is doing. And so that person down at the very coalface, sort of kicking in the door of a house in a military context, or, you know, selling a product to a client, or, literally at the coalface in a mining operation, understands that what they're doing is linked back to that overall mission they're seeing on the glossies or on the front door. Now, if there's a disconnect, it becomes really apparent, and it makes it difficult for people to make logical, cogent decisions. We spoke about the Prussians before. Karl von Clausewitz, who's sort of a godlike figure for anyone who's gone to an officer training institution. He talks about the military being an extension of politics by another means. So this idea that it is an arm, it's a tool of government that can achieve governmental policy. And this is a fantastic concept, and it should be a principle under which militaries operate. Unfortunately, in the modern age, we're often seeing a lack of clarity in terms of what the policy objective, what the political objective is of the use of the military tool. And I reckon the intervention into Libya was a really good example of that, where there was no real clear understanding of what the political end state was, which then makes it very hard as we cascade that down through the military all the way down to the individual flying a fighter jet on a bombing mission there to really have that golden thread of logic in terms of what they're doing and how that relates to that very highest commander's level intent.
And perhaps also Iraq and perhaps also Afghanistan, two other contemporary examples.
Yeah, it's actually pretty hard to find a good example
in the
modern age,
that's
which
true.
Is disturbing.
So I guess if, can I just perhaps summarise a little bit? Anyone that does work in an organisation that has a mission statement, you could look at that mission statement and see if the why is in it.
Hmm.
And the why generally will appear after the words in order to. And that why is intent. And that's probably more important than the mission statement itself. Would you agree?
Yeah. I think that intent, the why rather than the what, the purpose rather than the task, that's what allows you to make decisions in the heat of the moment. That should be the sort of guiding beacon that you're working towards. Because the what can go out the window very quickly. The example before, you know, seize the hill in order to provide fire support for the company attack. You know, if we see a better position to achieve the purpose, then we don't need to seize the hill. So, as you said, that why, that intent, arguably is the crux of it.
I like it. And also a really useful measure against the execution of tasks. Mm. As long as they conform inside that purpose, they don't achieve their mission, but they do achieve the intent,
yeah,
that's fine.
And as long, and this is the big caveat, and I alluded to it before, as long as that vision is actually what you're there to do. If you are there as a profit-making entity and you're espousing a vision of creating a better world or improving the environment or, you know, helping children, then that's fine, but that needs to be the intent by which you expect everyone in the organisation to work towards. Mm. And so you can see a subtle conflict crop up in some circumstances where we're not transparent with our actual intent. And that's why, you know, you see a lot of mature organisations who will talk openly about providing shareholder returns, because that is a key component about remaining a going entity, a going concern. And so I think as long as we're transparent about that and we're not too, idealistic or even, a little deceptive in those intent statements, those vision statements, then it's a good way to drive an organisation.
Okay, so I've read my organisation's mission statement. It's very strategic, mm-hmm, in order to change the world, in order to deliver shareholders' returns, mm-hmm, in order to create a better future for our children. How do I logically cascade that down?
Yeah.
To make sure that at the lowest level, everything is contributing to that strategic mission.
Yeah. This is essentially the role of strategy. This is putting the sort of task and purpose in a coherent intent and essentially lining up the ends, ways and means. So if we've got this overall vision, then now we're working out the ways of achieving that vision with the means at our disposal. And so that's the first step in this nesting. And so from that very top-level vision, you're then starting to get into these more tangible applications, the more tangible tasks that need to link back. And as we mentioned before, we want to fight to keep that consistency, fight to keep that thread in there. But one of the big things that we want to do as part of this environment, as we mentioned before, is empower subordinates, both in the planning and the execution phase. And of course, that requires an environment where we can tolerate failure, where we're willing to actually listen, to give airtime and actually listen to dissenting views, to incorporate them into our plan, to change our plan as a result of them where appropriate. But then when we're executing, to allow people the delegated authority to make decisions, because they're not always going to get it right. And if we're comfortable that if people make poor decisions but with decent intent, they're working towards the end state, then that's fine. That's an error of judgment. It's when we start getting to errors of character where people are making deceptive decisions or conducting sort of fraudulent or questionable behaviour, that's where we probably have very little room for tolerance. Mm. But we need to be able to tolerate errors, mistakes that are made within that well-meaning intent.
Mm. And that collaborative planning, back to that, which of course informs how we arrive at intent, that collaborative planning makes the plan stronger. And the key outcome, as we talked about before, is belief. People look at it, they've been part of it,
yep,
they believe in it, they yep know it's executable.
Yeah, and I think, in my personal view, this is increasingly important as we're coming into this sort of fourth industrial revolution where we're having a little bit of in a leadership sense, a paradigm shift from the old days where you would stay in one industry and you would have all that hands-on experience from your 15 or 20 years in the technical doer phase, then you transitioned to a leader and you knew everything there was to know about that industry, and you led because of technical power. Your power was resident in your knowledge about the industry itself. I think increasingly that's difficult because of a number of factors. One is that generationally, we don't tend to hang around for the gold watch in one organisation in the same way we used to. And so we're seeing people jumping industries, and so you're not necessarily going to have that depth of knowledge of a particular company and maybe not even the sector or industry. And the second one is that the rate of change is increasing so much. And I talk about this idea of the fourth industrial revolution, where we're seeing AI and the Internet of Things becoming more and more prevalent in every facet of society. And we as leaders simply can't be across all of that technical know-how. And in many cases, A, we don't have the experts within our company, or we don't understand them. And B, maybe we don't even want them. We don't want to own all the coders who are sort of working on the Internet of Things sensors. Maybe that's better off in a separate organization that we can contract to, you know, this sort of increasing gig economy where we're getting experts or business process outsourcing from a whole different country. So we don't have that sort of knowledge power that we used to. Mm. And so we need to be much more collaborative and harness that expertise from the people who really know what they're talking about at all levels within our organization and even outside of it.
Mm. Interesting. You know, we recently worked with a major European oil company where the CEO does not come from an oil and gas background. He actually comes from a consulting background.
Mm.
And as we stress tested their business, I found that his leadership was fantastic.
Yeah.
The absence of technical knowledge made him lead better.
Mm.
And it actually empowered his subordinates to deliver on their levels of technical knowledge. So it cascaded that intent and the ability to execute against the intent right down to the lowest levels of management.
Yeah.
And I would say that probably inside that crisis management and crisis leadership domain, he was one of the best that I've seen once we stressed the business.
Yeah. It's a really interesting topic, and in fact was the topic of an essay I assigned a bunch of MBA students very recently, and they came back unanimously saying that technical leadership is not necessarily a prerequisite, particularly at those higher levels. Technical knowledge is not necessarily a prerequisite for effective leadership, particularly at higher levels. So obviously at the lower levels where you've actually got your hands on the levers, you probably want to know what you're doing. You probably want to know how the technical things work. But as you get higher up, that specific, domain-specific skill is less and less important, and we're seeing more and more importance on what we call these softer skills, the ability to collaborate, the ability to communicate, the ability to inspire and make decisions under pressure. And that's not necessarily born of technical understanding.
You know, and I love that fourth generation leadership concept, and half the workforce in the US are baby boomers.
Yeah, yeah.
So their understanding of things that are highly technical probably is limited, considering that back in the day, computers were for nerds and no one ever had one.
Yeah, and they're certainly not digital native. They haven't grown up with this as just a constant facet of their life.
Mm. How do you incentivize this nested mission and intent process? And you talked about creating tolerances for failure.
Yeah.
But how do we incentivize it?
I think that is at the crux of how we sort of manipulate these systems. The theorists, the complex adaptive systems theorists, would tell us there's only about two ways we can influence a complex adaptive system, and that is defining the parameters and then looking at the incentive structures working within them. And we see in many organisations that the incentive structures are anchored on not failing. So we espouse these views of, you know, fail fast and learn from our mistakes, and we tolerate, you know, failure and all that sort of stuff. But when we scratch the surface on the incentive structures, things like our reporting systems, things like the esteem and status in which we're held within the organisation, things like our remuneration and bonuses, then most of them are, if not explicitly, then at least strongly implicitly linked to you know, not failing to sort of continuing the status quo. And so that is a pretty good place to start when you're analysing how your organisation works and how ready it is to move into this environment where we can tolerate failure and can develop this more adaptive stance towards it. Then, that's probably a pretty good place to start looking. Again, you need, like when you're looking at the vision and how it cascades in the organisation, you need to have a bit of a no-kidding, you know, candid look at it and really work to understand whether, you know, what you're espousing is translated into actual practice.
So I can not achieve my mission but achieve my intent, and that's okay. But is it relevant for all contemporary businesses, small to medium enterprise, all the way up to the multinationals?
Look, I think it is to varying levels. And again, a lot of this is based on complexity theory and the ability to adapt and seize fleeting opportunities, all that sort of stuff. Somewhere in there, though, there are a whole bunch of simple and complicated processes that we need to follow. So certainly we're not saying that you should have the flexibility to conduct an emergency drill in whatever way you see fit, or the flexibility to operate a piece of machinery, you know, in a sort of freestyling manner. There are areas where we need to stick directly to the process because it's a repeatable process. We've worked out what best practice looks like, and we want to be able to achieve that for efficiency and safety. So there are elements within any organisation where we do need to stick to the guns. This is more talking about the way we look at sort of planning and strategy, development, reaction from the environment, whether that's a sort of consumer client type thing or the natural environment, and then the interplay within the different parts of the organisation. That's when we're talking about complexity, and that's where we need to be very receptive and have that mission command style, that intent, but the decentralised execution.
Okay, let's summarise. How do I write my mission statement?
Who, what, when, where, why? But make sure that there's a task and purpose. So you want to be telling people what they need to do and why they need to do it. And that should be that golden thread of logic exist all the way through the organisation with all those what's and why's. But then you leave the how up to them.
So mission equals task plus purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And purpose is more important than task. How do I nest that?
Again, you need to take that step back and look at the missions at the various levels of the organisation and make sure that there is a cogent link, that the priorities of the board, you know, all the way down to the actions of the person literally at the coalface, as we said in the mining organisation, there is a cogent link between them.
And how do I measure it at all levels?
Feedback, two-way, sort of empowering your subordinates to drive fear from the room and to be able to have sort of candid feedback, and then looking at the incentive structures within the organisation and trying to align them to what you want to achieve rather than just a bottom line or a profit-driven sort of KPI, as is often the case.
With good collaborative planning equaling that belief we talked about previously.
100%. And look, again, it is almost a no-brainer. It is funny how much our ego comes into this, that why would you not harness the expertise of the people who are closest to the problem and who are doing it on a day-by-day basis, mm-hmm. the technical experts. And then, as we've mentioned before, then you can take credit for it.
Very smart. Good leaders do that. Okay, well, we love your feedback. And you can get in touch with us with ideas, recommendations, observations at debrief@unforgiving60.com. debrief@unforgiving60.com.
And you can also check us out on social media. That same handle, unforgiving60, U60, across a whole bunch of platforms, including Twitter, Instagram and LinkedIn.
LinkedIn and more. Just search unforgiving60 on your favourite social media. You'll find us there. Until next time, thanks, Ben.
Thanks, Tim.
And we'll see you all later. Now to the debrief. We relentlessly pursue excellence on Unforgiving 60, and we want your insights and feedback. And indeed, if you know someone who has great insights to share with us that have a practical difference, then get in touch with us at debrief@unforgiving60.com. That's unforgiving60.com. We love speaking to anyone who's been walking on the path less travelled and is generally living the life less ordinary. And if you like the podcast, please rate us on iTunes. You can also follow us on social media. Just search at Unforgiving60. That's Unforgiving60. Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. You know what to do. See you next episode on the Unforgiving 60.